Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have an open phone line that you can call with questions you may have about the Bible or the Christian faith or your own Christian life. You can call if you have a disagreement with the host. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And just as I gave that number out, it looks like our last open line got taken. But these lines do open up, and if you'd like to keep this number handy and call in a few minutes, you may find the line is open. The number is 844-484-5737. All right, and our first caller today is Earl from Roseville, California. Earl, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. I remember hearing you say on one of your previous programs that you wish the Christian church would be more like the early Christian church. I assume those are the ones that the Apostle Paul established. So my question would be, why can't the modern Christian church be more like the early church? Is it because the Christians would have to live in community with each other? And also, this is another little follow-up question. Why don't modern Christian churches exercise church discipline with its members? Is it because you think our modern American culture, it's because of our modern American culture, because we as Americans just like to have our independence and not tell us, not have anyone tell us what to do, even as Christians? And I'll just listen to your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Why is it that modern churches don't seem to be able to be like the early church? Well, I think you have hinted at some of it. You mentioned, would we have to live in community? I don't think all the early churches lived in a community such as we might think of, where a bunch of Christians live on a compound, and have all things common. But we do see that there was a communal or community spirit among them that isn't necessarily present in most churches today, so that we do read that they carried on their hearts the concerns of each other to the point that if they knew of a fellow brother or sister who was in need, then those who had more than they needed would share it. They would sell what they had and give to the poor in the church so that there were no people lacking. I don't see that kind of commitment to each other among people who are in the churches today, but then I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the gospel to which they responded that brought them into the church probably didn't include any information about that kind of a commitment, because many times the gospel that is preached does not really clarify the commitment that a person is expected to make, the total change in their life, the total surrender of everything they own and everything they have. That was preached by Jesus. It was preached by the apostles. And therefore, when people would respond and want to become Christians, they came with those terms in mind. They knew what they were signing up for. So the reason the church was different back then is because the Christians were different. And the reason the Christians were different is because the gospel that was preached was preached quite differently than now. The modern church is runs like a business. And in some ways, it's hard for it not to, maybe impossible for them not to, because they own buildings. Now, a building, a big building that's big enough to hold a church in, usually, if one person owns it and has all the liability for it and so forth, that's going to put a burden on that person. So they have instead a corporation owns it. So a church, generally speaking, is a 501c3 corporation. And a corporation has a board of directors and it has a CEO and it does business. And so churches have become business. Now, in the early church, meeting in church buildings was not really something they knew of. They met in homes, which meant, of course, they didn't have to have special buildings. They didn't have special costs for extra buildings and things like that. They could meet in the homes that were already occupied by their members. They also met in other public access areas in Jerusalem. They'd meet in the temple courts or in Corinth or someplace like that. They might meet in a school or a public access building that they could rent for meetings. It was a while before the church started building their own, getting their own real estate and things like that. And even when they did, I'm sure they didn't have anything like a modern corporation. In the first few hundred years, at least according to Didache, which is a very early description of how the church did things in the first and second century, they didn't really it, being in the ministry wasn't a professional thing. The church was not a business. The church was not even a corporation. It was a family. It was a family, and it was led by people who were called elders, who were probably, well, almost certainly, they weren't salaried. They may have been reimbursed, or they may have been helped, you know, the church may have helped support them, because the Bible does say that those who, you know, administer in spiritual things should be supported by the material assistance given by the church. But to be supported isn't the same thing as to be salaried. A salary is something that a corporation or a business, they write a check to somebody who's their employee. And that's a lot different than someone who's just, say, like a minister who's just serving God, and he doesn't care where the money comes from. He doesn't care if the money comes. He's doing it for the Lord and for the people. And then God provides for him through the people's appreciative gifts and things like that. That's a very different thing than being salaried or doing it, you know, on a contractual basis. But you see, the ministry in the centuries after the early church became a profession. And it became something that was a paid job. And so we've got now a church that's more like a business than it is like a family. And leaders who are more like employees than they are like voluntary, you know, big brothers in the church. Or in some cases, the ministers are not so much like employees as they are like owners, like they act like they own the church and that everyone's supposed to do what they say. None of this has any parallel in the healthy churches of the first century. Now, how would it be possible to, you know, go back to that? Well, you'd have to have ministers who have no monetary incentives. They'd have to be people who just want to serve God. People who want to serve people and serve God, and they're not worried about offending people by telling the truth to them. They're not worried about whether money comes in. If the money doesn't come in from gifts, they can get a side job, like many of us have done over the years. Many pastors have worked regular side jobs and ministered for free or gotten a little bit of help from the ministry, but supported themselves a great deal. But as soon as you remove the monetary motives for ministry, what you have then is a pastor who's capable of reading the scripture and finding out what it says and not worrying who he pleases or displeases by what he finds there, and who can follow his conscience and can start changing things in the church to make it more like it was when it was a pure thing, when it wasn't a business. Now, I think an awful lot of pastors, and I myself too, was raised in the institutional churches, so, you know, you don't just immediately read the Bible and see everything that you're doing wrong, because you see the Bible through the grid of what you're already doing and what you already think is right. So it takes a while sometimes. But now some pastors are doing the right things, and some churches are trying to move the right direction. But the biggest churches are the ones that have the biggest real estate issues, the biggest payrolls, I don't know, sometimes the biggest egos. And, you know, if that's true, all of those things are going to militate against those churches doing anything the way that they did in the New Testament. My series, Some Assembly Required, you might have heard it. Some of our listeners may not have. At our website, you can hear it for free. The website is thenarrowpath.com. And under the topical lectures, there's a series called Some Assembly Required. And that goes into a lot of this. Now, you said, what about church discipline? Why don't churches practice that? Well, a few of them do, but most don't, because, again, they're not interested in doing things the way Jesus said. That's a little costly. I mean, after all, if you start disciplining people in the church like Jesus said to do and like Paul said to do, you're going to end up stepping on some toes of some donors in the church whose tithes, you know, your salary depends on them. I mean, I know that sounds like a really cynical thing to say, and I guess it is, because I've been in church leadership. I've been in many churches, and I know a lot of ministers. And I have to say that while I'm not speaking about every minister I know, I would say that a great number of ministers would be very much threatened by the prospect of having to confront some of the richest donors in the church about the sins in their lives and say, you know, if you don't repent, we're going to have to ask you to leave. That'd be like professional suicide. Again, seeing the ministry as a professional thing, not as a spiritual ministry, not as a New Testament kind of church. But you don't find many churches today that are very much like New Testament church, partly because, again, the money. The money is a big issue, I think, for some people. It has to be. Or else, you know, it's hard to know what else would allow them to corrupt the church and keep it in this corrupt form for so long, unless it was a matter of losing a job, losing a salary. I don't know. Now, I suppose that a lot of pastors, I don't want to make it sound like they're all a bunch of monetary, you know, corrupt people. They're not. A lot of them think that what they're doing is what the New Testament church did. It's amazing to me. You know, when I see people go to a Roman Catholic church or an Eastern Orthodox church, or any kind of a real liturgical church where the people get all dressed up in the pastors and robes and things like that. You know, I think, do these people really picture Jesus dressing up in robes like this and, conducting these kinds of hocus-pocus ceremonies and things like that? I mean, what, do they believe that that's how the early church did things? And I suspect they do, because it's culturally all they've ever known. And it's just so, you know, it's hard for me to realize that what I see when I read the New Testament, and that is so different from modern institutional church, is not everyone sees it when they read it. They read the New Testament through the grid of their familiar traditions, and they just assume the apostles did this way too, which is, I don't know, it's kind of funny to me to think that someone could think that. But anyway, those are some attempts at answering your question. There's a lot of things involved, but it has a lot to do with the professionalism of the ministry and the finances of the church. That you know, to do things in the New Testament way, you'd have to not care about the finances. You'd have to care more about the people, about God, about your own integrity, about feeding the flock, about repenting and changing if you're doing things that don't please God. And let's face it, those attitudes would destroy many modern churches if they were adopted. All right, let's talk to Dale from Sacramento, California. Dale, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Brother Steve. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Thank you. I listen to you every day and have learned a lot. But some things I disagree with you about, but today I have a question for you.
Sure.
Concerning Revelation 20:1-10 and about the 1,000 years. Now, somebody told me yesterday about a view I had never heard called realized millennialism, with reference to being a historical teaching of the church, and followed it up with the idea that Christ is reigning now. And I've always been raised to believe in a system of biblical interpretation that refers to seven distinct periods in biblical history. So I'm questioning my own belief about God's redemptive plan focusing on national Israel. And I was wondering if you could help me with that question, realized millennialism, what is it? And
well, realize,
I will take your answer. I'll hang up and take your answer off the air.
All right, Dale. Thanks for your call, brother.
You're very welcome.
Good talking to you. Well, realized millennialism is just another name that some people have used for amillennialism. The reason they call it realized millennialism instead of amillennialism is, even though they believe exactly the same thing that's called amillennialism, the latter name, amillennialism, is a little misleading. Amillennialism, etymologically, the word means no millennium, which means that when you look at Revelation 20 and read about the millennium, the 1,000 years, it seems like the amillennialist is just kind of, you know, putting blinders over it. I say, I don't see it. There's nothing there. I don't believe in a millennium. You know, there's a millennium right there, so how can you say you're not don't believe in a millennium? Well, of course, the amillennial view holds that there is, of course, something that Revelation is talking about there, then which it describes as 1,000 years. But they don't believe that it's a literal 1,000 years. They believe that there's not a literal millennium or 1,000-year period of time being described there, but that the 1,000 years is symbolic for the church age. Now, some, because of the confusion over the word amillennialism, have suggested, I know Jay Adams was one of those who suggested this, and I think some other authors I've read over the years have suggested that maybe it's better to call it realized millennialism, which is to say that the millennium is not something that's coming up later, but it's something that's already been inaugurated. Sometimes they call it inaugurated millennialism. So they've got both of these ideas. It's inaugurated, that is, the millennium begins with the come when Jesus first came, and it represents symbolically the whole period of time until Jesus comes back, which of course is more than a literal 1,000 years, but that the 1,000 years simply represents that whole period. So that the present age is in fact the period of time that Revelation 20 is depicting there. But to use the word realized millennialism means that the millennium is not something we're still waiting for it to come. It's already been realized. It's already here now. Or to call it inaugurated millennialism or inaugurated eschatology. Sometimes that's another term they use for the same thing. You said that you have been raised with a dispensational view of things, and some of the things in it you're questioning. Well, I was too. I was raised with a dispensational view also. And dispensationalism is not amillennial or realized millennial. It's premillennial. And that is the view that Jesus will come back before the millennium starts. And therefore, of course, that view holds that the millennium hasn't started yet and is not realized or inaugurated yet. But that's a different outlook. The historic view of the church for most of church history was the amillennial or the realized millennial viewpoint. It didn't have the name realized millennialism back then, but it's the same view with a different name. And from at least the time of Augustine, if not prior to that, I know Origen was over a century before Augustine and held to this view. So from at least, about 300 AD onward, amillennialism was the primary view of the church. And premillennialism had existed for the first 3 centuries previous to that alongside it, and then kind of disappeared for a long time. Then about 1,500 years later, premillennialism reemerged in the form of dispensationalism in the 1800s. Now, as far as, critiquing the system, I'm not going to do that right here because my lines are full and because it's a broad subject. But since you were curious about the word realized millennialism, it is another word for the same thing as amillennialism. Now, if you would like to see a point-by-point critique of the dispensational system and a comparison scripturally between that and the amillennial system, that's what I provide in a series of lectures that you can hear for free at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com, and the series of lectures is at the topical lectures tab, and the series is called When Shall These Things Be? It's 14 lectures, but it's worth listening to them all because it really goes into, I talk about my journey when I was a dispensationalist and the scriptures I used to prove things like a pre-trib rapture and a future millennium and things like that when I was dispensational. And then it also talks about the thought processes and the scriptures and so forth that led me out of that. So if you're interested in a thorough comparison of the two and a critique of them, then going to thenarrowpath.com, going to the topical lectures tab there, and finding the series called When Shall These Things Be would be what I would recommend. Otherwise, I really can't go into it much more today simply because my lines are full and there's so many different aspects of the question that I would have to consider. But I do appreciate your call, and I hope you may continue your studies and grow in your knowledge of these things. Everett from San Pablo, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you, Steve. A couple of questions out of Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, Steve. My question is, what is meant by when it says him being delivered, by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God? What is the determinate counsel there? And then question number two is, when it says a little of, and somewhere, I don't know what verse it is, but it says, for David speaketh concerning him, I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand that I should not be moved. Could you give me your commentary take on that particular text?
Okay. Well, verse 23, where Peter is preaching at Pentecost and is in the middle of his sermon, he mentions Jesus as having come and been attested by God through his signs and wonders. And it says him, meaning Jesus, being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands have crucified and put to death. Now, you're wondering what it means that it says that he was delivered by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God. What it means is that Jesus was delivered over or surrendered over to his enemies to kill him. That God did that. It wasn't like the enemies just finally caught up with him too bad they got him, you know. But no, this is what God had in mind. God had predetermined that he was going to give Jesus over to these people to do what they wanted to do. That's what it says. So what he's implying is that God was in charge of Jesus' well-being, of his fate and of his life and his longevity and so forth. And even though there were people who were trying to kill him through most of his public ministry, they were not able to get to him. God didn't deliver him to them. They wanted to throw him off a cliff, but he walked through the crowds. They picked up stones to stone him on several occasions, but he walked through the crowds. He got away. They were simply not able to lay a hand on him because it was not his hour, the Bible says. So it's clear that the Father was not allowing his enemies to do the things they were trying to do to him through most of the time. But when it came time, when it was his hour to die, God delivered him over to them. And he did so not because he ran out of options and he simply couldn't save Jesus from him, but it was God's predetermined plan that Jesus would die. So he deliberately turned Jesus over to them and delivered him to them. And this deliverance of Jesus to his enemies was something that was pre-planned. And that's what Peter is saying there. Now, when Peter's quoting from Psalm 16, where David says, "I saw the Lord always before my face, therefore I will not be moved." And he's reading the context, or quoting the context, up to the point where David says, "You will not leave my soul in Sheol, neither will you let your Holy One see corruption." And Peter is assuming that David, though David is speaking about himself, is also speaking beyond his own experience, as he himself is a type of Christ and of the Messiah. And therefore, he's speaking in the person of the Messiah. The Messiah is saying this. And the particular point that Peter wants to make about it is that you will not leave my soul in Sheol, or in the Greek, in Hades. And then Peter, of course, preaches from that Jesus was, his soul was not left in Hades because God raised him from the dead. The idea is that everybody, when they die, they go to Hades. But Jesus was not left there. God didn't leave him there. He raised him and brought him out. And so that's the purpose of that citation from Psalm 16 by Peter on that occasion. Now, as far as the earlier verses in Psalm 16 that Peter quotes there in verses 25 through 26, I think he's, I don't know that there's anything in that Peter is intending to apply to his sermon. He's just giving a contextual quote of the verses that he does want to apply, which is what he quotes there in verse 27 and 28, especially verse 27, did not leave my soul in Hades. So that's how Psalm 16 is being used in that passage.
Okay, got it. Thank you so much for your time and your explanation. Peace and blessing upon you, Steve. Thank you so much. God bless.
Okay. Thank you, Everett. God bless you. All right. Adam from Massachusetts, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, if you need to hold me over, that's okay, but I'll try to get my question through now. Okay, so my question is regarding the law. So we know in the New Testament that Jesus, for example, gave at least two commandments, and there's probably more throughout there. But so my question is basically, how do we know which of the ceremonies and laws from the Old Testament were abolished in the institution of the New Covenant?
Well, all of them were, because Jesus said in Matthew 5:17 and 18, especially he said in verse 18, not one yod and not one tittle of the law will pass until all of it is fulfilled. So the question is there any part of that law, that ceremonial law, that has passed? Well, there has been a great deal of it that has passed. Well, Jesus said none of it will pass, not even a little bit of it will pass until it's all fulfilled. So what he's saying, it's not going to go out in bits and pieces. It's going to go out all at once. And until it goes all out at once, none of it's going out at all. So he says not one yod or tittle will pass until it's all fulfilled. So, what kind of things do we know have passed? Well, everything about the sacrificial system is past. The temple is gone. The Levites are gone. The altar is gone. The animal sacrifices are gone. That's about half. That's about half of what's in the Old Testament law is the whole temple system. So more than a jot or a tittle has passed. So it's like a major block, virtually more than half, really. And then, of course, there are other things that have passed, too. Jesus talked about their, no foods being unclean and things like that. So if anything in the law has passed, circumcision has passed. That's a big part of it, too. Then we have to assume that all of it has passed. Do you want to still be held over after the break?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll come back to you after the break here. We take a break at this point every day to let you know that the Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and if you'd like to help us stay on the air, basically that means help us pay the radio stations to keep us on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or you can do so at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Now, this weekend, I'm in Las Vegas, speaking Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday morning. You can find information at thenarrowpath.com under announcements. Please stay tuned for 30 seconds. I'll be right back.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we'd be glad to talk to you about those. If you have a different viewpoint than that of the host, I'd love to talk to you about that as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And before the break, we were talking to Adam from Massachusetts. And Adam, I think I answered your question, but there might have been, we had to cut off so quickly for the break, I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond or follow up on it if you needed to.
Yeah, so I guess the reason why I asked if there was anything that was held over from the old covenant is that a lot of people in the church will make reference to the Ten Commandments, but maybe that's just because they were reiterated in the New Testament.
Well, I think a lot of people in the church make reference to the Ten Commandments because they haven't thought through their ideas and the New Testament teaching about the law that well. But yes, most of what's in the Ten Commandments is the moral standards that have never been changed. They were important before the law was given. They're important after the law is no longer. You know, murder and adultery and stealing and bearing false witness and dishonoring your parents and blaspheming God. I mean, these are moral issues that anyone who ever did them in before the time of the law or since the time of the law is committing moral evil. You know, now that's not related, of course, to the special things that in the law that made the law special to the Jews. The special God, when God gave the law at Mount Sinai, he told the Israelites, if you keep these laws, you'll be a peculiar people, a special nation to me. So the laws that make Israel special are not the laws that say you should not murder and you should not commit adultery and you should not steal, because every pagan country had those laws too. The distinctives that set Israel apart from other nations was not only that they were expected to have a moral, criminal justice code like every other nation, but that they had special things that only they were required to do that no other nation was. That included circumcision, keeping the Sabbath day, having the calendar of festivals that they did during the year, the dietary restrictions on certain foods. God never gave those laws to any other people than Israel, and those were the ceremonial laws. Those were the ones that not everybody's expected to do. But of course, laws like, you don't murder, don't kill, don't commit adultery, those are Every religion is going to have those. Every nation, every secular nation is going to have laws about those things. And, of course, so even though the law has passed, that code of righteousness and justice, that predates the law and lives long after it. And so Jesus, of course, did repeat a lot of those things. Jesus did, of course, talk about murder and adultery and telling the truth and honoring your parents and those kinds of things. But he was, you know, in doing that, he wasn't reaffirming, the Torah. He was simply reaffirming what every country knew about right and wrong. But when he talked about the Torah commandments, the specific commandments that were ceremonial, he never affirmed them. He never said that his disciples were supposed to continue these. Now, he did assume that while he was on earth, they would be doing it because he would not yet have fulfilled them. He's going to fulfill them in his death and resurrection. And so he did speak to them as if he knew they would be going to the temple and doing those things. For example, in Matthew 5, he says, when you bring your gift to the altar, if you there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift at the altar and go and make peace with your brother. He's obviously picturing his disciples in the temple offering animal sacrifices, which is what they did, what they would continue to do until it was fulfilled.
All right. Well, thank you for your answer, Steve.
All right, Adam. Thank you for your call. Good talking to you. All right. Let's talk to Andrew from New Hampshire. Andrew, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there, Steve.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a breakup on the phone, but I don't know if that's your end or mine, but go ahead.
So I was going through Exodus, and I came across this passage where Moses is recruited by God with a burning bush and all. And then right after that, there's this passage about him staying at an inn and the angel of God coming to kill him. And then his wife circumcises his kid. She touches his sandal with it. It says, like, this is a blood oath or something. And then God decides not to kill Moses. What's up with that? He just got recruited. Like, why was God trying to kill Moses right then?
Yeah. Well, it's very perplexing, and people ask about that a lot. It's in Exodus 4. I believe what it is that Moses had been remiss in a duty, and that was the duty of circumcising his son. I don't know how old his son was. You can't tell from the story whether the child is a baby or a young boy or a young man, but the child should have been circumcised when he was 8 days old, and that had been neglected by Moses. Now, God doesn't always crack down on you the first time you do something wrong. Sometimes you live a whole lifetime in disobedience before you really get convicted about it, and, you know, I mean, sometimes, there are areas that people are missing. For example, the whole generation that came out of Egypt neglected to circumcise their children. It wasn't until they came into the promised land with Joshua that they circumcised that whole generation. So there was a lot of neglect going on there. And Moses had neglected that too. And yet here God had now called Moses to be a prophet, to be confronting a pagan king with the order that you need to obey Yahweh. Well, here's an area of disobedience in Moses' own life where he wasn't obeying Yahweh. And maybe that could be overlooked for a while, but it can't be overlooked if you're going to go stand up for God and tell somebody else to obey Yahweh. You can't be a hypocrite. You've got to make sure your obedience is in place before you go preaching to others. You can't be saying, let me get the speck out of your eye, Pharaoh, when you've got a glaring log in your own eye. So this was a matter where now that God had commissioned him and he was on his way to go face Pharaoh, God was going to have to deal with this area where Moses had been just kind of ignoring what he was required to do. And so there was this scene where it says God sought to slay him. It's not clear exactly what that looked like. You mentioned an angel, perhaps, and maybe that's what it was. It may be that an angel came and wrestled with him like with Jacob that time. Or it may be that some commentators think maybe he just got really sick and was almost going to die, and they recognize, uh-oh, God is angry because we haven't circumcised our child. But Moses was too sick or too preoccupied or something with this struggle to do anything about it, so his wife stepped up and did it. And she circumcised the son, and then God left him alone. So God was just holding out, really, for this obedience to take place in Moses' life. And the reason it was now instead of some other time is because Moses had been spending 40 years doing nothing very important on the, you know, watching sheep in the desert, but now he's going to be doing something very important. That's going to be a preacher. And if God's calling you to be a preacher, you better make sure that any compromises in your life that you've been kind of ignoring, those get squared away before you go telling other people what to do. And that's pretty much what was going on here.
Okay, interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Good talking to you.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to Don from Sacramento next. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path. By the way, I'm coming up to Sacramento in about 3 weeks, I believe.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. I was wondering if you could talk about how it is that our Lord Jesus Christ said it's not what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person. And at the same time, Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden after they had eaten fruit from the forbidden tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I'll just listen off the air.
All right. Thanks for your call. Well, you actually misquoted, but I understand what you meant. Jesus actually said it's not what goes into a man's mouth that defiles him. It's what comes out of his mouth. Now, this was on the occasion where the disciples had been eating food in a way that the Pharisees didn't approve of. It wasn't bad food. It's just that they weren't washing their hands in a ritualistic way that the Pharisees felt someone should. And so they're saying, how come your disciples will eat food with their hands unwashed? And they're suggesting that if you don't, you know, toe the line on this, then you're guilty of something, that you're sinning. And Jesus is saying it's not what you put in your mouth that determines whether you're sinning or not. It's what comes out of your mouth. He explains, because what comes out of your mouth is what comes out of your heart. And sin, of course, is a matter of the heart. It's not a matter of, how many calories or what kind of calories you put into your mouth to feed yourself. That's not what sin is. Now, you ask, well, how can that be harmonized with Adam and Eve being cast out of the garden for eating the wrong kind of fruit? Well, obviously, since God told them not to eat that fruit, it was a sin for them to put that in their mouth. So, I mean, that was just about the only sin available to them to do. God hadn't forbidden anything else than that. Just don't eat that fruit. So if God says don't do something and you do it, well, that's a sin. In that particular case, the test he was giving of their obedience was a matter of eating or not eating something. And that's, God did the same kind of thing with Israel, in that he gave them some dietary laws, say don't eat this and don't eat that, but eat these other things. And whenever God gave those, this was, the test. Are you going to be loyal to me or are you not going to be loyal to me? But Jesus is saying, God could use anything for a test. He could use a test, say, don't eat that. But it's like if you tell your kid, this birthday cake is for your sister's birthday later today. Don't touch it and don't eat it. And he goes in and he steals a piece of cake and eats it. Well, that's a sin, because stealing is a sin. Eating cake is not a sin. Eating cake isn't what defiles a person, or eating anything else. It's not, the food you eat, no food is sinful to eat in itself. But there are foods that you should not eat because it's not okay for you to eat. If it's not yours, for example, you're stealing. That would be the case with Adam and Eve. They were stealing fruit that God told them was not theirs to have. Or if God said, listen, I don't want you to eat this kind of food for this period of time, as under the law, there are some foods that he said that he didn't want them to eat. Well, then, during that period of time, you shouldn't do what God said not to do, because disobeying God is where sin comes in. And Jesus is saying food itself doesn't have any moral stigma attached to it. But, of course, any kind of action will have a moral stigma attached to it if it's something that you're commanded not to do and you do it. So Jesus is simply saying, you Pharisees are making it sound like a person becomes guilty by eating without washing their hands. Now, by the way, there was no command in Scripture anywhere about the washing of the hands before eating like this. So this was not a command of God at all. The Pharisees, however, had decided that certain eating is unclean if just in itself. And Jesus said it's not. What goes in your mouth isn't going to have an immoral impact on you. but what comes out of your mouth does, because that your words come out of your mouth, and that comes out of your heart, and that's where sin is found. All right, Cecilia from Squim, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Good. There's something that happened to me back in December in a church that my family was attending.
Uh-huh.
And something happened, and the pastor contacted me via email and told me that I have 1 week to respond, or I was not welcome in his church any longer.
Really?
And I want to... I'm sorry?
Really?
Hello?
Tell me about it.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
And so I want to tell you what happened shortly, briefly, so you can understand. My daughter was going to the youth group, and she was bullied and harassed by a kid, and the kid was gossiping about my daughter, and I talked to the youth pastor, and he didn't listen. So the next week, my daughter called me and said, Jacob, the boy that was harassing her, is here. Mom, come and pick me up. So I went to pick her up, and the boy called his mom and told his mom that I was harassing him. The mom called the police. The police came to the church, and the youth pastor backed the harassing boy and the mom that called the cops on me. So I went to my women's group that I was attending at that church, and I called the leader for prayer, and she said she has her own issues. So I asked for prayer in my small group, and then someone went and gossiped about me with the pastor. And so the pastor listened to the gossiping, and then it when he sent me that email. I responded to him, and I said, I would like to go on one-on-one and talk to you. And he said he won't do that. I need to meet with the elders and the youth group leader. And I said, please reconsider that again. And he said, no, 1 week, you didn't come. I'm going to tell all my leaders that you're not welcome at this church. And that's briefly what happened. My daughter
okay.
was just out
well,
of
let me ask you.
Group.
Let me ask a few questions about that, okay? Because you mentioned things like, well, they gossiped about you, and they said that you were harassing them, and they called the police. You didn't tell me really how that scene went. Now, when you went to pick up your daughter, and mm-hmm. the boy's mother said you were harassing him, were you speaking to him? Were you confronting him?
No. The leader, the other leader, was waiting for me, and the uh-huh. two boys that were talking about my daughter were there, and I said, can I talk to only one? And the one that was harassing, I said, can you just go away? That's all I did.
Uh-huh.
That boy called his mom because I got the police report. That boy called his mom and said, Mom, she's harassing me. And the mom came so furious and called the police. And I felt bad because I was at church.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
the youth leader, the main leader, had all the kids in another room, almost like mm-hmm. if he set up all of this to have a reason to kick my daughter out of the youth group and me, because I always was telling him, you know, you're giving them too much sugar. You know, how is possible that my daughter can eat 15 mini muffins in 1 hour, you know, and can you please don't feed sugar to my daughter? Or how come these girls walking on the tables kicking trash cans?
How old is your daughter?
You know?
How old is your daughter, madam?
My daughter is 13.
13. Now, you know, it's not just a matter that they are feeding her 15 muffins. It's that she is taking them off of a plate and putting them in her mouth. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. But if
okay, so nobody is making her eat those. I'm assuming. Is that correct?
It's true. But if they
yeah.
wouldn't feed, if they wouldn't put them in there,
yeah.
it's 1 hour on Sunday. She was going on Sundays while I was attending the church, and within 1 hour. They couldn't say one donut or one muffin.
Sure.
And,
I mean, well, you could tell her that. You could tell her, you know, only one. You know, I do think one of the problems that we have in our social settings, including church social settings, is that snacking is often not healthy. I mean, they don't have healthy foods for it. And lots of times young people are tempted to eat too much of the wrong thing, and so probably there is a lot to be said for asking the church to not place those temptations there, especially if your daughter's not very strong at resisting it. But obviously, I mean, your daughter's going to be living in a world where there are donuts and things like that. So I mean, she has to learn how to control herself as well. But, I mean, from the way you tell the story, it sounds like you've been very much wronged by this church. And I don't, you know, if I don't know what their side of the story would be. It sounds to me, from what you've said, that they've reacted rather hastily to reports that you say are not true about you, in which case, you know, this church may not be a very good place to go. Not just because they're not treating you right, but because a church that treats anybody that way is not a very healthy church, it seems. Now, of course, I'm not hearing their side, and I don't know what all has transpired between you and them before this time, but I don't think you need me to tell you that they're doing the wrong thing, because I think you're calling me because you know that they're doing the wrong thing. So I'm not sure what kind of advice you want from me, except to say, should you leave the church? Well, it sounds like they want you to. And if a church wanted me to leave, I'd leave, you know? I mean, frankly, there's been a lot of churches that wanted me to leave, and I did. But it's sad. It's sad to leave a church where you have friends there and stuff like that, but if the church is so dysfunctional that they deal with small issues like this in such an inconsiderate way, then I'd say you don't have any leadership there at the church that has any spirituality, again, unless the situation is considerably different than what you described. But, yeah, not much else I can do for you. I'm sure that maybe you just kind of like to have a chance to share, you know, the frustration. But... And you've done that. And I, you know, if it's as you say, then I'm going to agree with you that the church has gone wrong on this. I appreciate your call. Vicki from Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I have a question about something new I heard about.
Okay.
So I was on the internet and I was searching out an ex-Mormon that I've listened to before. And I was going to go watch his testimony again. And when I went to this site where they had it posted, they said that he and his wife, so he converted to Mormonism, she was a Mormon. But he and his wife that had this wonderful ministry helping Mormons understand the false teachings of Mormonism are now in a fringe sect of a non-messianic Judaism known as B'nai Noach, the Noahites. Have you heard of this?
I don't think I have.
It has to do with following seven laws of Noah.
Okay, well, I know about the Noahide laws. Yeah, there's the Jewish rabbis have a view that although Gentiles who are not proselytes to Judaism are not required to keep Torah, they do believe that Gentiles are supposed to keep the seven Noahide laws. And I have a list of them somewhere. I don't have them memorized because there's nothing biblical about this. This is a rabbinic tradition. But it includes things like not murdering, not eating a limb from a living animal. There's some strange things there. I think adultery is on the list and some idolatry and some other things like that. I forget the total list. Most of it's pretty basic stuff, but it comes from the rabbis. Who, you know, they're dealing with the fact that there are some Gentiles who don't want to really become Jews, don't want to get circumcised and stuff like that, but they want to live a life that's pleasing to God. And they believe, as these rabbis believe, that God has put more restrictions on the Jews than on the Gentiles, because they believe the Jews have a higher calling than Gentiles have. But the Gentiles, if they want to be pleasing to God, have to keep these seven Noahide laws. Now, you know, if somebody was a Christian and they went into that view, it's just another version, of people slipping into Judaizing. You know, I mean, it's a Judaizing idea. There's nothing in the Bible about keeping the Noahide laws. Not even in the Old Testament is there, and there's not in the New either. But in the New Testament, of course, Christians are supposed to be keeping the commands of Christ, obeying Christ, following Christ. That's the obligation of the Christian. The obligation is not to keep the Jewish Torah. And the obligation is not to keep the Noahide laws. The obligation is to follow Jesus. That's, you know, it's amazing how many ways people can go astray from the simplest and most obvious New Testament teaching, and that is that Jesus is the Lord. Obeying Jesus is what it takes to be a follower of Christ, just a Christian.
So they've renounced faith in Jesus Christ along with this.
So it would seem, yeah. I mean, and so they're apostates. But there's people who've done so in other ways. If they're trying to keep the Noahide laws, there's people who go further than that, and they try to keep the Torah laws. And some of them actually convert to Judaism, actually. And this is, of course, this was going on in Paul's day. The whole book of Hebrews was written to warn people about that and to warn them that if you do that, you've lost your salvation. So that's the way they've chosen.
It's interesting that they had such a vibrant ministry to the Mormons, but I think they got so focused on that, they must have, that they were kind of, you know, right in line to fall into something else. You
there's
know,
only because... one thing. There's only one thing that's safe to focus on, and that's Jesus. And
yeah.
A lot of times people, they don't want to just focus on Jesus. And I've said this many times because I think it must be true. I don't know how it can be true, but it must be true. They find Jesus boring. You know, anyone who really focuses on and knows and follows Jesus will never find him boring and will never feel like, wow, I need something else. I need something more than this. But there's a lot of people who, I guess, been in the church. They thought they knew Jesus. Apparently they didn't. Whatever it is they thought about Jesus, they found it boring. So they want to add some kind of pizzazz to their religious life. So they add the Torah or they add the Noahide laws or they add signs and wonders or they add this or that little thing. And they're hoping that that is going to find them whatever it is they're looking for. But you see, as soon as you start looking somewhere other than Jesus, you're straying from Jesus. That's what Paul told the Galatians about the law. You know, well, you know, you start adding to the gospel, you've got a perverted gospel. You're no longer a Christian. You've fallen from grace. He said you're estranged from Christ if you're trying to keep the laws. Same would be true of the Noahide laws.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you for your call, Vicki. God bless you. All right, not much time left, but Rich from Spokane, you get the last minute or so. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I'm just curious. When Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt, who was left behind? Did Egypt have a whole bunch of other slaves, or did they just crumble and fall after that?
Well, Egypt, Egypt was pretty impacted economically. I mean, their whole agricultural system was wiped out with, you know, the hail and the murrain on the cattle and things like that. The army was wiped out in the sea. I mean, Egypt was pretty much brought to almost nothing, and they never rose again to the height they had been. They may have still had some slaves that didn't get away that were not Jewish. I mean, certainly Egypt would have slaves from all over the world, not just the Hebrew slaves. And we're told in Exodus 20 that when the Hebrew slaves left, they didn't go alone. It says a mixed multitude went with them. So probably there were slaves of other nationalities who kind of just inserted themselves in the group and said, hey, the door's open. I'm going to slide on out with these people. So, but we don't have any way of knowing if every slave that Egypt had, you know, left, though the Israelites did and some others besides. I'm sorry I'm out of time, but I hope that answers the question for you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you want to from the website. Everything at the website is free. Certainly check it out. I've mentioned some of the resources here on the air. Everything there is free. That's thenarrowpath.com. I am speaking in Las Vegas this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If you're interested in that, you can find at our website information about where that is. That's at thenarrowpath.com under announcements. Thanks for joining us.